Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bill Fletcher, president of Trans Africa Forum, who examines the agreement by the Group of Eight industrialized nations to cancel at least $40 billion of debt owed by 18 of the world's poorest countries. Anita Dunch, research director of the National Priorities Project, who discusses how cuts in military spending could enhance national security and restore some funding for critical domestic needs. And columnist and civil liberties advocate Nat Hentoff, who takes a critical look at the Bush administration's push to make permanent controversial provisions of the USA Patriot Act. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Marking a new low point between the Republicans who run Congress and the United Nations, the International Relations Committee in the House of Representatives passed a bill authored by Committee Chairman Henry Hyde that could cut in half U.S. dues to the UN if certain reforms are not adopted. According to the Interpress Service, the proposed reforms include funding most UN programs voluntarily rather than through mandatory dues from the 191 member states. It also requires a new rule that prohibits alleged human rights abusers from sitting on the UN Human Rights Commission. The Hyde bill also calls for the U.S. to withhold funding for new or expanded peacekeeping operations until specific reforms are in place. The Hyde bill was strongly criticized by defenders of the UN, such as Don Kraus of Citizens for Global Solutions, who asserted the bill will only further exacerbate our isolation in the world community at a time when we need allies. For months, Republicans on Capitol Hill have expressed public outrage about the UN oil for food scandal and comments by UN Secretary General Kofi Annan that the U.S.-led war in Iraq violates the UN Charter. Senator Norm Coleman, a Minnesota Republican who heads a key Senate committee, has called for Annan to quit. George Galloway, a British member of Parliament accused of involvement in the oil for food scandal by Coleman, testified before a Senate committee and called the charge, which he denied, the mother of all smokescreens. Ignoring harsh criticism from human rights groups and the United Nations, longtime Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe is pushing ahead on his massive slum clearance campaign that has left 200,000 people homeless. 22,000 people have been arrested, mostly small traders in Harare, the capital city, and other urban areas, who have opposed Mugabe's 20-year rule. Speaking to the new parliament on June 9th in a session which was boycotted by the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, Mugabe said it was necessary to go after black market traders in currency, drugs, and key commodities like sugar who work outside government regulation in crime-ridden areas. In Geneva, Miloun Kotari, a leading UN expert on the right to housing, blasted the crackdown as a violation of human rights. He said the sweep would make Harare a city of the rich, for the middle class, for the well-off, and the poor are pushed away. Kotari predicted that ultimately 2 or 3 million people could be displaced by the slum clearance operation in Zimbabwe. Since Mugabe's government started seizing white-owned farms 5 years ago, Zimbabwe's economy has shrunk by 50%, and many people have been forced to become street vendors in order to survive. With unemployment at nearly 80%, 70% of the people in the southern African nation are poor, and one-third are in need of food aid. For the first time, animal rights activists in the U.S. are on trial for using tactics branded as terrorism by the government. In federal court in Trenton, New Jersey, prosecutors have charged 6 members of the group Stop Huntingdom Animal Cruelty with violating the Animal Enterprise Protection Act, which in 2002 was expanded to include the crime of animal enterprise terrorism. The 6 animal rights activists face a possible 3-year jail sentence and a $250,000 fine. In recent years, activists have waged an intense campaign against Huntingdon Life Sciences, a British-based company with operations in New Jersey, that tests drugs and food additives on animals. The animal rights group has allegedly harassed Huntingdon employees, published their names and addresses on its campaign website, and threatened their family members. Andrew Erba, a defense attorney for the 6 activists, told Reuters, "This is a referendum on the rights of a political movement to talk about these things in the open." In recent testimony to a U.S. Senate committee, the FBI's counterterrorism chief, John Lewis, claimed that direct action animal rights groups were now more dangerous than the Ku Klux Klan, radical anti-abortion groups, and other right-wing extremist organizations. The FBI is investigating 1,200 incidents connected to animal rights groups over the last 15 years. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski. After years of petition drives, protests, and direct action by grassroots organizations across the globe, the Group of Eight industrialized nations agreed to cancel at least $40 billion of debt owed to international lending agencies by 18 of the world's poorest countries. The nations affected, 14 of them in Africa, must adhere to neoliberal free market economic policy and anti-corruption measures. Money not going to debt service will be dedicated to funding health, education, and other anti-poverty programs. Non-governmental organizations from around the world that had long campaigned for debt relief greeted the G8 agreement with guarded optimism. Some pointed out that economic conditions attached to the debt relief program exacerbated poverty. Other organizations noted that 44 impoverished nations not covered in the G8 agreement will continue to be burdened by devastating debt. British Prime Minister Tony Blair, chair of the upcoming G8 summit in Scotland, had led the effort for debt relief and is still hoping to gain commitments to double current levels of international aid to poor African nations. But Blair's appeal for Washington to sign onto an expansion of Africa aid was rejected by President Bush. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Bill Fletcher, president of Trans-Africa Forum, who examines the G8 debt agreement and the continuing struggle to combat poverty in Africa.
Well, my reaction is very mixed, I mean, just to be honest. On the one hand, any cancellation is a good thing, and it's moving things the way that they should go. But I think that it's important for your listeners to remember that the cancellations that were announced were the result of these countries accepting the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank's prescriptions for their economies. So in other words, it's like this. It would be as if I said to you, I will cancel your personal debt, but you have to divorce your wife, send your kids to the schools that I pick with the curriculum that I like, and start buying the food that I think you should have. So it's that sort of arrangement that these countries have found themselves in. It's very unsettling. I think the other part is that it's far from complete. There are obviously many more countries that are in a similar situation in terms of odious debt. And on top of that, there is a perception that I'm starting to see in the media that because the number $40 billion is thrown around, that there's an assumption that this is it. I mean, that no further assistance is needed, when that's exactly the opposite case, that great levels of assistance are going to be needed at this point.
Lay out for us, if you would, the economic policies, the privatization, the free trade policies that these poor countries must adopt in exchange for receiving this debt relief.
Well, you certainly hit two of them. In all fairness, there's anti-corruption policies that the countries must adopt. I mean, no one's in favor of corruption. But the privatization is very, very important. I mean, a number of these countries had nationalized broad public sectors growing from their beliefs as to how their economy should be shaped. As a condition of getting assistance, they had to privatize. They had to give up the decisions that they themselves had made, you know, about what their economy should look like. And so there's been privatization of electricity, of water, telecommunications in various cases. So you have that. Then you have, as you mentioned, free trade agreements. You know, listening to President Bush talk about free trade agreements is really quite sickening when you realize that there is no such thing as free trade on this planet, that the bigger economies always figure out ways of protecting certain key sectors of their own economies, and that no country has ever developed on the basis of free trade from a state of underdevelopment. It's never happened. Yet what's being asked and not asked, demanded of Africa, Asia, Latin America, the Caribbean, is that they follow a path that has never been proven to succeed. And then, of course, last week, Prime Minister Blair was here to try to convince his good buddy that the United States should increase their aid to Africa. I mean, I think it's humiliating from the standpoint of Britain. I mean, here it is that Blair put everything on the line to back an illegal invasion and occupation of Iraq. And you would just simply assume that President Bush would do a little extra for his ally. No, nothing. He basically digs up this figure, $650 million of aid for the African continent that he's going to add. But it turns out that wasn't his number anyway. The Congress had already allocated that amount. So effectively, Blair went home empty-handed. The situation is cynical when one looks at what's actually going on.
Bill Fletcher, where do you see the struggle headed now in terms of fighting poverty in Africa and other impoverished nations across the world after this G8 initiative here?
I think the countries of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean really need our continued voice and support in demanding full debt cancellation and significant increase in assistance for economic development purposes. You know, Prime Minister Blair was saying that the assistance needs to be doubled. And I think that he's right. I mean, we need to be looking at the equivalent of the Marshall Plan that was used with Europe after World War II and the devastation to rebuild Europe. That sort of assistance is necessary. And the economies of North America, Europe, and Japan are more than capable of providing that assistance. And so I think that this is where the fight needs to be. And we need to make this fight integral to everything that we do. I mean, one of the problems in the United States is that when it comes to Africa, we've allowed the media to put us to sleep. You know, people think of Africa as a house of horrors, that nothing ever works there, that it's a basket case, or we know very little about what's going on. And those of us that are active, those of us that are conscious about this, that have any concern, need to become more vocal. And this can't be the activity only of organizations in Washington, D.C. It's got to be organizations at the local level.
That was Bill Fletcher, president of Trans Africa Forum. Call the group at area code 202-223-1960 or visit their website at www.transafricaforum.org. Under the proposed federal budget for 2006, military spending totals $450 billion, seven times as much as all other homeland security and preventive measures combined. And that doesn't even include the $70 to $100 billion a year the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are costing. That money, due to political, not budgetary considerations, is not included in the defense budget. Last week, the National Priorities Project released a study showing how $53 billion could be cut from the military budget and redirected to increased protections against terrorist attacks, while also allocating $13 billion more into domestic needs. Those dollars, for example, could provide health coverage for almost 3 million uninsured Americans or build more than 100,000 low-income housing units. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Anita Dunch, research director of the National Priorities Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization. She discusses how national tax and spending policies impact the country across a broad range of issues and programs.
We could have better security for less money. This is based on a report written by a number of partner organizations. And what's been found is that we could conservatively cut military programs by about $53 billion. Then we could redirect some of that money, in fact, most of that money, into other types of programs that improve our security, such as preventive measures, which include diplomacy, working internationally, and securing nuclear materials abroad, or homeland security, such as improving the security at ports or nuclear facilities or chemical plants. What we find is that we still have money left over. So basically, if we have a much more comprehensive, better security policy, we could have it for fewer dollars. We have left about $13 billion, and those dollars could be put towards deficit reduction or they could be put towards addressing domestic needs.
The federal budget surplus when Bill Clinton left office was projected to grow to $5.6 trillion over the next decade, and instead the deficit for last year alone was $445 billion. That's an amazing turnaround.
In 2000, when the Bush administration took over, the federal budget was in surplus, meaning we were taking in more money than we were spending. But quickly, that evaporated to nothing. And there's two major reasons why we now have large deficits. One is because of all of the various tax break packages that were passed over the last few years. And the second reason is because there's been this enormous boost in military spending and homeland security spending. You know, there's a number of military programs that continue to be funded, even though they're really from the Cold War era. These programs are unnecessary or they're redundant, and basically they're cost ineffective. For example, the F-22 Raptor aircraft. This is something that in the budget there will be $4.3 billion spent on next year, even though we can use less costly aircrafts and do what this aircraft is meant to do. Other examples are the submarines, there's destroyers. These are costing billions of dollars to develop new technologies to advance destroyers or submarines, even though they're really developing technologies to address the Soviet threat. And again, the Soviet threat has ended. The type of threats we face today require different measures. So we can save money on these unnecessary, redundant programs. We have existing weapons that can do the same thing, and we can save money. For a very small amount of money, for less than $1 billion, we could redirect that towards some acts that have been proposed in Congress, such as the Chemical Safety Act, which would require chemical plants to assess their vulnerability and undertake appropriate measures to ensure better security in our homeland.
The latest budget issue that's drawn a lot of attention is the House plan to cut the budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting almost in half. Of course, a lot of people think that it's a political move, but the Republicans are couching it as a necessary budgetary move.
Congress wants to cut that percentage-wise by a tremendous amount. But if we look at how much money it would be cutting, it would be less than $200 million. This is a trivial part of the budget. In fact, if we look at our tax dollar, it's 2/100ths of a cent of our tax dollar. This is a very, very small piece of the federal budget, and yet the argument is to cut it because we need to reduce the deficit.
Anita Dunch, do you see any moves by Congress to try to address the military squeeze on domestic spending? I know that Representative Lynn Woolsey, a Democrat of California, has introduced some kind of resolution regarding this.
There was a congressional resolution out of Representative Woolsey's office to shift some of the unnecessary military spending into programs that would address security deficits and address domestic needs. It may be proposed to be more than a congressional resolution and to actually be an amendment to an appropriations bill for the Department of Defense. But again, this will only happen if people let their elected officials know how they feel about these issues.
That was Anita Dunch of the National Priorities Project. Contact the group at area code 413-584-9556 or visit their website at www.nationalpriorities.org. The 16 provisions of the USA Patriot Act, passed by Congress just 6 weeks after the September 11th terrorist attacks, are set to expire at the end of 2005. The Bush administration is now campaigning hard to make permanent some of the more controversial portions of the act that are due to sunset in December. In a closed session on June 7th, The Senate Intelligence Committee voted to make permanent 8 of these provisions and went on to expand the powers of the FBI to subpoena an individual's business records, allow wiretaps and searches without presenting links to terrorism or obtaining a judge's approval. President Bush stated that the Patriot Act has given law enforcement officials the powers needed to make the nation safe from terrorism. Although the president recently claimed that the legislation has resulted in 400 arrests and helped convict 200 people on terrorism charges, the Washington Post found that only 39 had been convicted of crimes related to terrorism. Congressional opponents of some key provisions of the Patriot Act have been stymied in their attempt to publicly challenge the administration's claims and expose abuse of the law. A June 10th House Judiciary Committee hearing was abruptly ended by Committee Chair Republican James Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin after hearing the testimony of 4 witnesses who questioned the constitutionality of the Patriot Act. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Village Voice columnist and longtime civil liberties advocate Nat Hentoff, who takes a critical look at what's at stake as the Bush administration pushes to make permanent controversial provisions of the USA Patriot Act.
The Senate Intelligence Committee is chaired by Pat Roberts. The idea of what the kind of person he is, he has steadfastly refused to allow the Democratic ranking member, Jay Rockefeller of West Virginia, to even put in an amendment to have an independent inquiry of how we treat prisoners that we call detainees. But now he's gone beyond that in terms of attacking the core of the Constitution, many people would say, and that is the Fourth Amendment. Through his insistence in a closed-door session, he had the committee, a large percentage of the committee, pass a proposed bill that would give the FBI extended powers in a section of the Patriot Act that is now expanded so that the FBI can now issue that by themselves. They write their own subpoenas. They do not have to go to a judge, and they can secure personal records in all kinds of places, medical offices, libraries, post offices, and the like. The only people who can challenge this are the institutions that get the subpoena, whether they're doctor's offices or libraries or educational institutions. They can challenge it, but very few of them are likely to because they have no incentive to. They don't care what happens to the individuals whose records have been seized, and they'd rather not go to the bother and expense of going to court. The only way to stop this will be if the Senate Judiciary Committee, which is headed by Arlen Specter, puts up a countermeasure. Now, one of the things that drives me crazy, here is a really serious attack on an essential part of our liberties. I don't expect the Republican leadership to protest about it, but where are the Democrats? I haven't heard a word from the very outspoken, showboating Howard Dean, nothing from Nancy Pelosi, nothing from Harry Reid. My 2 senators, Hillary Clinton and Chuck Schumer in New York, have been silent about practically all of what's been going on in attacks on our basic constitutional liberties. So the Democratic Party, you know, people say they're looking for some vision, something to identify themselves. Why on earth don't they identify themselves as Democrats, as protectors of the Constitution? Because clearly the president is not.
Nat Hentoff, defenders of the Patriot Act often claim that the provisions of this legislation help fight terrorism. In fact, President Bush himself claimed 400 people were arrested and 200 convicted under the Patriot Act, protecting the nation from terrorism. The Washington Post, as you and listeners know, found out later it was really only 39 people connected with terrorism convicted under that bill. How important is the Patriot Act to the fight against terrorism, in your view?
Well, I'll give you an indication. During one of the public hearings before the Senate Intelligence Committee, Valerie Caproni, who is the head of the legislative office of the FBI, was asked, can you show us any evidence that because there is a delay under the present law where you have to go to a judge to get this kind of subpoena, has there been any damage to national security? She paused and said, well, I can't give you any of that, but it could happen. This is all a scam by the Justice Department, as it was under John Ashcroft and as it is now under Alberto Gonzalez. There have been very, very few prosecutions under the Patriot Act. Most of the people who have been arrested, some have been deported for violations of immigration laws, but they haven't busted any cells. You know, the Lackawanna Six and all, once people began to examine those cases, they fell apart. So the Patriot Act, so far, all it's done is to give a lot of Americans, and now I think about over almost 400 cities and towns and seven state legislatures that have passed Bill of Rights defense resolutions, telling their congressmen and congresswomen to stop this and change the Patriot Act, because there is a chill in the country, not among all people, but both conservatives and liberals in large numbers and growing numbers are afraid, because all of this stuff is secret.
What's at stake, in your view, with the Patriot Act and these enhanced provisions just passed by the Senate Intelligence Committee? What should citizens be concerned about when it comes to an erosion of the Bill of Rights?
If this continued assault on the essence of who we are, which is the Bill of Rights and much of the rest of the Constitution, if there is another 9/11 or anything comparable to it, biochemicals released in subways, attacks on schools, hospitals, or whatever, the government, which is already now clearly feeling empowered to do what it wants. Some people may have seen on C-SPAN how in another committee, the House Judiciary Committee, James Sensenbrenner, because he was impatient and didn't want any opposition to what he was trying to push through, simply stopped he just knocked his gavel down and said, "We're through." And various congressmen said, hey, we're not through, but he just walked out. So there's an arrogance of power there. And if there is something like 9/11, we will be in the position, I think, and I try not to be, you know, say the sky is falling when it's only raining. But if there's another 9/11, there will be what the Japanese Americans had to experience during the Second World War. There will be internment camps for people who disagree too strongly with the government or who are suspected of disagreeing.
That was syndicated columnist and civil liberties advocate Nat Hentoff. Read Hentoff's columns online by going to the Village Voice website at www.villagevoice.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at www.btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly program summaries and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Top. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Elaine Osowski, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.